for Indoor Entertainment is with us once again. Many of the shows we visited in our last series of London Mirror are still drawing the crowds through the lighted portals, but much louder than before, the cry of bingo is heard in the land. Pete Seeger, the folk singer, is chopping logs on concert platforms while he sings a work song. And the controversial film The Connection, set in a heroin addict's pad, is the main attraction at the Academy. The London Symphony Orchestra, which gives a concert at the Albert Hall tomorrow night, has caused the downfall of a fan. He walked along the street, conducting it, in his imagination, in the Thunder and Lightning Polka. When he got to the part where the cymbals crash, he clapped his hand so forcibly that his feet slid from under him and he fell through a 40-pound plate glass window. Like to try? Ballroom season has begun. On gleaming acres of polished parquet, serenely smiling ladies with lacquered hair in spangled skirts like parachutes swirl decorously with gentlemen in white tie and tails with numbers on their backs. Followed by the spotlight, the champions glide and caper, trot and slither. The English style was formulated in 1924 when a committee set down the basic steps. But this winter comes a challenge, a new dance called the twist. It's being promoted in two films now being made. It's Trad Dad and Hey, Let's Twist, which are racing for first release. But a chiropractor named Mr. Plimpton says, morally, I'm opposed to it because I'm a parent. Physically, I'm against it because of the far-reaching effect of spinal distortions it can cause. So we'll play the music of the twist for you, but only if you promise not to get up and dance. Twist is the latest dance craze, but the song of the week is undoubtedly His Latest Flame, because it sprung from nowhere to top of the hit parade in a fortnight. Why? Because Elvis Presley has recorded it, and the hit parade is based on record sales. Has the song any other merit? To find out, we've arranged for a performance not by Mr. Presley, but in their own treatment by our resident team, the Michael John Singers. You are the judge.
Eternally, and the reason name of his latest play.
The latest three-hour color spectacle destined for long runs in the cinemas of the world is a remake of King of Kings, The Story of Christ. It's a Samuel Bronston production, and it had its London premiere at the Coliseum, home of spectacle, on Wednesday night. And the critics were, well, critical, as must have been expected. The director of this expensive epic is Mr. Nicholas Ray, who made Rebel Without a Cause, The Savage Innocents, Johnny Guitar, and many other famous films. The National Film Theatre on South Bank is about to run a season of his pictures, and on the 26th, he will make a personal appearance there. I went along to his hotel this week to have a few words with him about King of Kings.
Mr. Ray, in a film of the tremendous scope of King of Kings, I imagine that a tremendous amount of research was necessary.
Yes, it was. All the best advantages were provided me in terms of personnel with biblical scholars of different religious beliefs and different denominations, very outstanding scholars. So I had a considerable amount of theological guidance. I also had a great deal of historical guidance. It's a pity that not all of it could go into one film. But the another attractive aspect of the film was that this was certainly an age of expectancy, an age of turbulence, and we have tried to capture the feeling of those times without the characters outside of the Christ having any foreknowledge of the future, or the characters having no sense of their historical roles, but rather it all happening for the first time. It is too bad that a great deal more of the significant detail of the times could not have been kept in.
But this is the first time that an actor in the character of Christ has spoken on the screen, isn't it?
Yes.
It's pretty daring, isn't it?
I don't feel it's daring. I believe in the character of Christ as portrayed by Jeffrey Hunter. We have tried to honor the visual and emotional concepts that people of different lands, different creeds, different backgrounds may have, and allowing them enough latitude to read in their own interpretations, their own images, rather than trying to force a particular style, a particular way, a particular image upon them. Although there is the visual representation, I feel that this is certainly a story in which the audience will want to do some of the acting itself.
Mr. Ray, do you think that the content of King of Kings has any relationship to the position at the present moment in the world?
I hope the audience will believe that it does have. I am very encouraged at the receipt of a letter from a very sophisticated friend of mine in New York, who writes that it is a pleasure to go into the New York drawing room and hear people talking of the life of Jesus rather than about fallout shelters.
We have a recording from the soundtrack of King of Kings of the music from the Nativity scene by an aggregation of musicians called the Symphony Orchestra of Rome and the singers of the Roman Basilica, conducted by the composer, the highly successful writer of film music, Dr. Miklós Róża.
Thank you.
listeners in Australia will be pleased to hear that their own glamorous Maggie Fitzgibbon looks like occupying the leading lady's dressing room at the Prince of Wales Theatre for many months to come. She's playing opposite the popular star Max Bygraves in the American musical Do Re Mi. And we've invited her to the studio to let you hear two of the numbers from the show. Maggie, you've come a long way from theatricals in Melbourne. How does it feel?
Well, being in a success field is marvellous, Will. Particularly after three short runs. But you know, I rehearsed more than I performed last year. But this is not the first American part I've played. I was also in Kiss Me, Kate in Australia. But I must say I love the crazy characters I've been playing lately, and particularly this one with a comedy star like Max Bygraves as my husband.
Yeah. Tell us about the songs from Do Re Mi that you're going to sing.
Well, I thought it would be fun to sing a couple of songs that I don't actually sing in the show.
Good idea.
The first is a sort of Ema Sumac number, which is actually the turning point of the story of Do Re Mi. You see, my husband discovers a beautiful young girl singing in, of all things, a pancake parlor. And overnight he turns her into a big star. And here's the song she sings. Without a romantic song, and this next one suits my philosophy and yours too, I hope. Make someone happy, make just one someone happy, make just one heart the heart you sing to, one smile that cheers you, one face that lights when it nears you, one man you're everything to. Fame, if you win it, comes and goes in a minute. Where's the real stuff in life to cling to? Yeah.
musical comedy to review, from the sparkling Prince of Wales Theatre by Leicester Square to the Little Fortune Theatre hard by the vegetable market at Covent Garden, where the most brilliantly irreverent show for years is setting a new standard in satire. Beyond the Fringe, four clever young men and a jammed box office. Here are two of them, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, in a sketch which comes on quite early in the show. This is, well, all about a chap who goes to the theatre, not so much for the show as for, well, it's called Royal Box, and like everything else in the show, it tells its own story.
Excuse me, I'm a sprightly boy. I got held out of the Haymarket. All lights were against me.
That's all right. You've only missed 3.5 minutes of the overture. It's a 7.5 minute overture, actually.
I see. It was in the show before, have you?
Oh, yes. I've seen this show now. Let me see. 367
times. 367
times?
That must be some sort of a record. Are you that fond of the show?
Oh, no, it's not my sort of show at all, really.
Well, why on earth do you keep coming?
Well, you see, it's the royal family.
The royal family?
Yes, you see, I read in the newspapers that the royal family was planning a visit to this theatre. So, naturally, I came along, you see. Look, see up there, that's the royal box. But there's no royal people in it at the moment. No royalty there. No royal personage gracing the royal box. Unless, of course, they're crouching. But, I mean, that wouldn't be royalty, would it?
Not crouching, no.
But, anyway, last Tuesday I was here, and I saw, believe it or not, I saw the Duchess of Glastonbury.
The Duchess of Glastonbury, lucky old you.
Yes. But, I mean, she's not really what you'd call regal, is she?
I suppose the Duchess of Glastonbury is more what you'd call noble rather than regal.
Yes, noble rather than regal, but you don't hold it against her, do you? No. But, anyway, I am hoping against hope that one day the royal family will turn up and make my having to sit through this rotten, awful show every night worthwhile.
You really mean to say you spend 12 and 6 every night just on the off chance that you may catch a glimpse of the royal family?
Well, it's not worth 15 shillings.
Tonight, the vast red and gold auditorium of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, is crowded tier upon tier for the last performance of the season of Beethoven's Fidelio. For the London-born prima donna, Amy Sheward is the Leonora. It was not possible for us to take a relay from the theatre, so we recorded Miss Sheward earlier in the week. Miss Sheward, you've been singing recently in Europe.
Yes, I have just come back from making my debut in Vienna. For my actual first performance, I sang Turandot, and then afterwards I have been singing Aida.
Was this in the great and famous State Opera House there?
Yes, this is one that was rebuilt after the war, and it is indeed a very great and beautiful opera house, but personally I prefer the part which has been left, the old part, which is really far more beautiful than the modern part.
That's the part that wasn't destroyed by
that's
the bomb.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Well, we've read in the press about your great success, and we'd like to congratulate you very sincerely. What
Thank
are you going
you.
To sing for us?
I'd like to sing for you a favorite aria of mine from André Chenier. It is Maddalena's aria, which she sings in the second act, and in it she tells of the terrible experiences which he has just been through.
Oh,
Thank you, Amy Sheward. Now, this week at the Criterion Theatre in Piccadilly Circus, a play by Hugh and Margaret Williams called The Irregular Verb to Love chalks up its 250th performance. Hugh Williams, you've seen him on the screen, well, he's the star as well, and naturally he's pleased with the success of his play. Here he is to tell us something about it.
This little excerpt is from the second act of what's called a domestic comedy, which means it's about a family and the relationships between parents and children. In this case, the mother, played by Joyce Redman, has perhaps too kind a heart, which has prompted her to blow up a couple of fur shops as a protest against trapping animals. She's just finished a prison sentence. The father, played by myself, is a curator at the zoo. And our son, Andrew, played by John Standing, has only yesterday returned from Sardinia with a Greek girl who speaks no language but her own. We live in a maisonette in Regent's Park, and you'll be glad to hear it's a lovely evening in the month of May.
Hello.
Hello, my darling.
I thought so. You've got my shoes on.
Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't find mine this morning.
I took them to be mended.
Do they fit?
No, they're too small and they hurt like hell.
Good.
Did you have a nice day?
Yes, thanks.
Did you have a proper lunch?
Oh, quite proper. Disgusting, too.
Oh, dear. Where?
Filthy place in the Tonicor Road. My own fault. I grudge money on food. Go somewhere cheap. Absolutely hate it and don't eat anything.
What have you done with Fedra?
She's in my room looking at a picture book.
Andrew, darling.
Yes, ma'am?
Your father and I have been talking.
Oh, about Fedra, I suppose. Well, don't worry, she won't be here long, and it's jolly sweet of you to help.
No, not about Fedra.
About me, then. Your father and I have been talking. It's a toxin sounding, isn't it? I should have guessed. Well, what have I done?
Nothing, darling. That's the whole point. Not a damn thing. You haven't even learned any French.
I don't want to learn French. I want to learn English.
Yes, but you're 22, and it's time you decided what you're going to make your career. Now, you've had a jolly good time, and your father, well, Daddy, has been very generous. But you can't expect that to go on indefinitely.
I don't.
Well, then, it's time you settled to something. It's time you got a job.
I have got a job.
Oh, but how wonderful. What sort of job? When did you fix it? When do you start, darling? Why didn't you tell us?
I start on Monday fortnight, and I fixed it before I left.
Left where?
Before I left Sardinia.
Sardinia?
Yes.
Do you mean you're going to work in Sardinia?
Yes.
Doing what?
Driving a motorboat for water skiing.
Driving a motorboat?
Sounds a healthy life without much promise of advancement.
And then in the evenings I'm going to help with the waiting and serve in the bar.
You're going to be a waiter, oh, my dear boy.
Well, I shall get my board and keep and 4,000 lira a week.
And how much is that?
It's about £2.10.
A week? But it's not a proper wage.
Now, stop talking like an agitator. In prison you only got 11 pence.
Oh, Felix, I wish you'd try and help instead of making silly little jokes. Really, here's your only son, whom we hope will go into the Foreign Office, saying he's going to be a boatman in the daytime and a barman at night, and all you can do is make hurtful little jokes and read the newspaper.
I'm trying to find the rates of foreign exchange. I don't think it's quite as much as £2.10.
Oh, well, I shall get tips, too, of course.
Yes, in the bar, you might. And water skiing, too, for that matter. Give him a few minutes extra time and so on.
But that's not the point.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought it was.
The point is, he's going to be a barman in Sardinia.
Only till the end of September.
And then, I suppose, you've got something perfectly splendid lined up. Like being a shepherd.
Oh, by then I shall have finished my novel and saved up enough money to go to Greece for the autumn.
A novel? Are you really writing a novel?
What do you think I've been doing in Sardinia? Besides, I told you in a letter. No, perhaps I didn't. Perhaps that was the one that got wet and I never sent.
I say, it's rather exciting, isn't it? How much have you done?
More than half, about 50,000.
50,000? What, words?
No, lira a week.
Oh, Felix, really, why do you keep trying to make fun of me?
Well, you know, it's a habit I've got into. I don't seem to be able to get out of it.
Now, do we know any publishers? Felix, what about yours?
No, they don't do novels.
Well, this time you suggested they did.
No, dear, I don't think so.
Now, let me think. I know Mark Gilchrist.
He's dead.
Oh, dear. Oh, what a nuisance. Well, aren't there any publishers who are members of your club? Well, of course, you wouldn't know. You never go there.
Well, as a matter of fact, I've got a publisher. I think Upton's are going to do it.
Darling, that's rather exceptional, isn't it?
I don't know, I've no idea.
And what's it about?
Ooh, people, I suppose.
Ah, that's a pity.
Why?
More money in animals nowadays. Oh, I don't mean research work like mine. I mean biographies of otters and so on. And you can't go wrong with cats, you know.
I thought I'd dedicate it to you and Ma, on condition that you never read it.
You're afraid we'll find out too much, is that it?
Well, of course. Anyway, I've got an advance of royalties from Upton's. That's why I went to see him this morning.
Advance of royalties before books finished. They've never offered me that.
Well, he didn't exactly offer it.
Then how did you get it?
Well, he wanted to know how long I'd take to finish it. So I said, well, I couldn't give him an answer, but I'd probably never finish it because I was flat broke and had to take a full-time job in order to earn some money. So he called in his secretary and told her to write me out a cheque for £100. I asked for cash, of course, because I didn't have a bank. Quite straightforward and very simple. The only trouble is, I have got a full-time job, and now I promise to do the damn thing by the end of September.
You're wasting your time writing. You should go into commerce.
I may have to teach Fedra how to work the motorboat. That'll give me the mornings.
Do you mean you're taking Fedra back to Sardinia with you? Are you in love with her, darling?
Oh, Ma. I do adore you. Of course I'm not in love with her. People nowadays don't go falling in love all the time like you did. We're too well emotionally adjusted for that.
Oh, I see. Do forgive me, I didn't know. One leads a very sheltered life in prison. And of course, when I was a girl, if one shared a haystack with a young man, it was usually supposed that one's emotions were involved.
Exactly, but then look at your divorce rate. Now, if I were to fall in love and start thinking in terms of marriage at my age and without any security, I'd be guilty of what criminal psychologists call a diminished sense of responsibility. No, we don't fall in love. We form an association.
Has it a large membership?
No. I mean an association, a friendly, unemotional association between two people.
But sexual, I take it?
Oh, well, of course.
How do you account for all the runaway marriages nowadays?
Oh, but they're always heiresses, aren't they? Besides, the ties and responsibilities of having parents is quite enough without the addition of a wife. Anyway, until one's 30 or so.
Where are you going now? I think my associate would like to know how many she has to cook dinner for.
Oh, I thought I'd better take Fedra out for a walk before that. I put her in the National Gallery all day and she needs some air.
You're a responsibility to us, not we to you.
I don't agree. I think it's mutual.
We've made great sacrifices.
Oh, yes, but they're self-evident. The sacrifices a child makes for his parents are far less obvious. Right from the moment he's born. But there you are. Where there's love, there's sacrifice.
Oh, well, it's very nice and comforting to know he loves us, isn't it, Felix?
I'd say a lot more than most offspring, because I like you both.
What do you mean a child makes sacrifices right from the moment it's born?
Well, I'm not speaking personally, of course, you mustn't think that, but how many babies are there who much prefer a bottle? But in order to satisfy the emotional urge of the mother, they're denied it. And so it goes on. Fancy dress parties, Peter Pan, getting stung at picnics, blackberrying in the rain, bathing in the English Channel. They're all absolute misery. But children try to look as though they were enjoying themselves in order not to spoil the parents' fun. And what's more, they do it with very good grace. Study the faces of grown-ups and children at a pantomime sometime and you'll see that I'm right. Well, I shan't be long.
Do you still think he needs you? Do you still think you can help him? Oh, it's a good thing, my darling. It's a good thing. You mustn't be sad when your fledgling learns to fly. Well, that's one of the situations the parents cope with in the irregular verb to love. They also have a daughter. But we haven't got time to tell you about her now. Good night.
Top of the bill at the London Palladium. That's the ambition of every comedian and every singer in the business. The present bill topper is both. Two men, one suit of clothes. Harry Secombe. What's more, he started a third activity. He's a budding author, if you can imagine Mr. Secombe budding. Harry, now that the goons are broken up, do you feel lonely without them?
Help! Yes, I do. Yes, well, it's a bit lonely without the old coons out, because miss all that blacking up, you know. When I was with Milligan last night, he's still up and about.
Oh, is he?
And occasionally get pigeon post messages from Peter Sellers, you know.
Oh, yes.
Through the window.
What will you do after this Palladium season, Harry?
Go home.
Yes.
I live there, you know.
Yes.
No, I've been actually at there from May and the 19th, and I'll be there till December, and then I'm off to the West Indies for a short stay.
Ah.
Actually, we're going to Huddersfield. We're sending postcards in the winter.
What's this thing I hear about you going to Vienna?
Well, I'm going to Vienna, yes. I'm to record with one of these Viennese orchestras. We're taking them over with us, as a matter of fact. Because they're in Vienna, we call them a Vienna orchestra, you see. Recording an LP, long playing record.
Jolly good.
About 7 foot three long. To play it round the edge. I don't know where I get it from. Make it all back.
So you've taken up writing, Harry. How'd you come to be doing that?
Well, when I was two, I went to school. I was sitting in the dressing room one afternoon. There was an empty sheet of paper in front of me and a pencil in my hand, and I started to write. A, B, C, it began. One cat, dog. Uh-huh. Before I knew where I was writing.
You were? Well, could you give us an example of your writing?
Funny you should say that, because I happen to have a rather well-written piece in my hand here.
Oh, please.
Cecil Beaton, Cartier of Ottawa, Lord Snowden and myself have one thing in common. We all own cameras. How we use them, however, is a lens of a different focus, to coin a photographic phrase. The first camera I ever had was one my father obtained by smoking cigarettes with the free gift certificates inside the packets. He finished up with a chest condition, and I with a box brownie. When it arrived, I could hardly wait to get outside and take pictures of the rain bouncing off the roof of the colliery buildings. For an hour, I snapped pictures gaily leaping around in the rain with no coat on and wearing a pair of thin slippers. Two rolls of film later, I had a chest condition and my father had the box brownie. I have come a long way since then. You will never see me out taking pictures in the rain today without a stout Macintosh and a pair of Wellingtons. And that, I think, is the first lesson the amateur photographer should learn. Always wear the right clothes for the shot. The second important thing is to examine your photographs very carefully when you get them back from the chemist. First of all, to see whether they're ones that you took. That black smear on the left-hand corner of your snap of Worcester Cathedral could be somebody else's Auntie Gladys. And since when did you take a shot of the shipyards in Barrow and Furness? However, I should hang on to them. They're probably much better than the ones you've got, especially that one of the blonde in the deck chair. We shall now deal... with camera shake. Take more water with it. I think that's rather aptly dealt with that. Now, a common fault amongst photographers is the finger in front of the lens. A friend of mine went away for 3 months to South America with 5 rolls of 36 exposure films and came back with 180 pictures of his index finger. Fortunately, they were color films, and we were able to see his finger getting appreciably browner as he got towards the end of his holiday. I must say, he has beautifully shaped whorls. W-H-O-R-L-S. He corrected his fault by depressing the shutter lever with his chin, doing away with the right hand altogether. As he was managing a circular saw factory at the time, this was rather easy for him. It is not a method I would recommend, except in extreme cases. Every photographer occasionally yearns to see himself before his own lens and is driven to using the little lever in front of the camera, which is put there for that express purpose. I'm afraid that I've never been successful with this particular shot. You have to set the focus, press the lever, and run desperately for the empty chair in the middle of the room before the buzzing noise stops. To date, I have 14 pictures of the back of a Harris tweed jacket and a beautiful close-up of the sitting room carpet taken by the camera as it crashed to the floor when the tripod was kicked aside by my retreating foot. Last week, I found the answer to this pressing problem. Get your portrait painted. Invite your friends to stand around it and click away. The only snag is that you'll probably have to sell your camera in order to pay for your portrait. I hope that these few hints will help you to get bigger and better snapshots of your index fingers.
Thank you, Lord Seacombe. Let us now hear from you in your third capacity as a singer.
Now hear that lovely melody, a drinking song from the student Prince. Thank you.
Drink, drink, drink to eyes that are bright as stars when they're shining on me. Drink, drink, drink to lips that are red as sweet as the fruit on the tree. Here's a hope that those bright eyes will shine lovingly, longingly soon into mine. May those lips that are red and sweet tonight with joy my own lips meet. Drink, drink, let the toast start. May young hearts never part. Drink, drink, drink.
Drink, drink, drink to love that are white and warm as again, tenderly trustingly soon around mine. May she give me a priceless boon, a love beneath the sweet May moon. Drink, let the toast start. May young hearts ever part. Drink.
Well, that was the first of our new series of London Mirror. You heard Amy Sheward, Maggie Fitzgibbon, Nicholas Ray, Hugh Williams, Joyce Redman, John Standing, Harry Secombe, the Michael John Singers, the BBC Review Orchestra, leader Julian Gaillard, conductor Malcolm Lockyer, and on gramophone records, the London Symphony Orchestra, the Symphony Orchestra of Rome, and the singers of the Roman Basilica, and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. The program, which was recorded, was produced for the General Overseas Service of the BBC by Trafford Whitelock. And this is Wilfred Thomas, hoping you'll be there at the same time next week with the set tuned in.
Street lamps aglow and newsboys calling. City, I know, it's mine.